Disc 5.
I shook my head. It's interesting, you know. I must mention it to Graves. He asked if we could tell him definitely of anyone who hadn't had one. She's the second person, I said. There's Emily Barton, remember? Nash gave a faint chuckle. You shouldn't believe everything you're told, Mr. Burton. Miss Barton had one, all right. More than one. How do you know? That devoted dragon she's lodging with told me. Her late parlourmaid or cook, Florence Elford. Very indignant she was about it. Would like to have the writer's blood. Why did Miss Emily say she hadn't had any? Delicacy. Their language isn't nice. Little Miss Barton has spent her life avoiding the coarse and unrefined. What did the letters say? The usual. Quite ludicrous in her case. And incidentally insinuated that she poisoned off her old mother and most of her sisters. I said incredulously, "Do you mean to say there's really this dangerous lunatic going about and we can't spot her right away?" "We'll spot her," said Nash, and his voice was grim. "She'll write just one letter too many." "But my goodness, man, she won't go on writing these things?" "Not now." He looked at me. "Oh, yes, she will. You see, she can't stop now. It's a morbid craving. The letters will go on. Make no mistake about that." Chapter 9. I went and found Megan before leaving the house. She was in the garden and seemed almost back to her usual self. She greeted me quite cheerfully. I suggested that she should come back to us again for a while, but after a momentary hesitation, she shook her head. "It's nice of you, but I think I'll stay here. After all, it is, well, I suppose it's my home, and I dare say I can help with the boys a bit." "Well," I said, "it's as you like. Then I think I'll stay. I could... "Yes," I prompted. If anything awful happened, I could ring you up, couldn't I? And you'd come." I was touched. "Of course. But what awful thing do you think might happen?" "Oh, I don't know." She looked vague. "Things seem rather like that just now, don't they?" "For God's sake," I said, "don't go nosing out any more bodies. It's not good for you." She gave me a brief flash of a smile. "No, it isn't. I didn't much like leaving her there, but after all, as she had said, it was her home. And I fancied that now Elsie Holland would feel more responsible for her. Nash and I went up together to Little Furze. Whilst I gave Joanna an account of the morning's doings, Nash tackled Partridge. He rejoined us, looking discouraged.
"Not much help there. According to this woman, the girl only said she was worried about something and didn't know what to do and that she'd like Miss Partridge's advice."
"Did Partridge mention the fact to anyone?" asked Joanna. Nash nodded, looking grim.
"Yes, she told Mrs. Emery, your daily woman, on the lines, as far as I can gather, that there were some young women who were willing to take advice from their elders and didn't think they could settle everything for themselves offhand. Agnes mightn't be very bright, but she was a nice, respectful girl and knew her manners."
"Partridge preening herself, in fact," murmured Joanna. "And Mrs. Emery could have passed it round the town."
"That's right, Miss Burton." "There's one thing rather surprises me," I said. "Why were my sister and I included among the recipients of the anonymous letters? We were strangers down here. Nobody could have had a grudge against us." "You're failing to allow for the mentality of a poisoned pen. All is grist that comes to their mill. Their grudge, you might say, is against humanity."
"I suppose," said Joanna thoughtfully, "that that is what Mrs. Dane Calthrop meant."
Nash looked at her inquiringly, but she did not enlighten him. The superintendent said, "I don't know if you happened to look closely at the envelope of the letter you got, Miss Burton. If so, you may have noticed that it was actually addressed to Miss Barton, and the A altered to a U afterwards." That remark, properly interpreted, ought to have given us a clue to the whole business. As it was, none of us saw any significance in it. Nash went off, and I was left with Joanna.
She eventually said, "You don't think that letter can really have been meant for Miss Emily, do you?"
"It would hardly have begun, 'You painted Trollope,'" I pointed out, and Joanna agreed. Then she suggested that I should go down to the town.
"You ought to hear what everyone is saying. It will be the topic this morning."
I suggested that she should come too, but, rather to my surprise, Joanna refused. She said she was going to mess about in the garden. I paused in the doorway and said, lowering my voice, "I suppose Partridge is all right."
"Partridge?"
The amazement in Joanna's voice made me feel ashamed of my idea. I said apologetically, "I just wondered. She's rather queer in some ways. A grim spinster. And the sort of person who might have religious mania."
"This isn't religious mania. Or so you told me," Graves said.
"Well, sex mania. They're very closely tied up together, I understand. She's repressed and respectable, and has been shut up here with a lot of elderly women for years."
"What?"
I said slowly, "Well, we've only her word for it, haven't we, as to what the girl Agnes said to her. Suppose Agnes asked Partridge to tell her why Partridge came and left a note that day, and Partridge said she'd call round that afternoon and explain, and then camouflaged it by coming to us and asking if the girl could come here?"
"Yes."
"But Partridge never went out that afternoon."
"We don't know that.
We were out ourselves, remember?"
"Yes, that's true."
"It's possible, I suppose." Joanna turned it over in her mind.
"But I don't think so, all the same. I don't think Partridge has the mentality to cover her tracks over the letters, to wipe off fingerprints and all that. It isn't only cunning you want, it's knowledge. I didn't think she's got that. I suppose..."
Joanna hesitated, then said slowly, "They are sure it's a woman, aren't they?"
"You don't think it's a man?" I exclaimed incredulously.
Not an ordinary man, but a certain kind of man? I'm thinking really of Mr. Pye."
"So, Pye is your selection.
Don't you feel yourself that he's a possibility? He's the sort of person who might be lonely and unhappy and spiteful. Everyone, you see, rather laughs at him. Can't you see him secretly hating all the normal, happy people and taking a queer, perverse, artistic pleasure in what he was doing?"
Graves said a middle-aged spinster.
"Mr. Pye," said Joanna, "is a middle-aged spinster."
"A misfit," I said slowly.
"Very much so. He's rich, but money doesn't help. And I do feel he might be unbalanced. He is really rather a frightening little man.
He got a letter himself, remember?"
"We don't know that," Joanna pointed out. "We only thought so. And anyway, he might have been putting on an act.
For our benefit."
"Yes. He's clever enough to think of that. And not to overdo it.
He must be a first-class actor."
"But of course, Jerry, whoever is doing this must be a first-class actor. That's partly where the pleasure comes in.
For God's sake, Joanna, don't speak so understandingly. You make me feel that you understand the mentality."
"I think I do. I can just get into the mood.
If I weren't Joanna Burton, if I weren't young and reasonably attractive and able to have a good time, if I were, how shall I put it, behind bars, watching other people enjoy life, would a black evil tide rise in me, making me want to hurt, to torture, even to destroy?"
"Joanna!"
I took her by the shoulders and shook her. She gave a little sigh and shiver and smiled at me.
"I frightened you, didn't I, Jerry? But I have a feeling that that's the right way to solve this problem. You've got to be the person, knowing how they feel and what makes them act, and then perhaps you'll know what they're going to do next."
"Oh, hell," I said. "And I came down here to be a vegetable and get interested in all the dear little local scandals."
"Dear little local scandals. Libel, vilification, obscene language and murder."
Joanna was quite right. The high street was full of interested groups. I was determined to get everyone's reactions in turn. I met Griffith first. He looked terribly ill and tired, so much so that I wondered. Murder is not, certainly, all in the day's work to a doctor, but his profession does equip him to face most things, including suffering,
the ugly side of human nature, and the fact of death. "You look all in," I said. "Do I?" He was vague. "Oh, I've had some worrying cases lately, including our lunatic at large." "That certainly." He looked away from me across the street. I saw a fine nerve twitching in his eyelid. "You've no suspicions as to who?" "No, no. I wish to God I had." He asked abruptly after Joanna, and said hesitatingly that he had some photographs she'd wanted to see. I offered to take them to her. "Oh, it doesn't matter. I shall be passing that way, actually, later in the morning." I began to be afraid that Griffith had got it badly. Curse Joanna! Griffith was too good a man to be dangled as a scalp. I let him go, for I saw his sister coming, and I wanted, for once, to talk to her. Amy Griffith began, as it were, in the middle of a conversation. "Absolutely shocking," she boomed. "I hear you were there, quite early." There was a question in the words, and her eyes glinted as she stressed the word early. I wasn't going to tell her that Megan had rung me up. I said instead, "You see, I was a bit uneasy last night. The girl was due to tea at our house and didn't turn up."
"And so you feared the worst. Damned smart of you."
"Yes," I said, "I'm quite the human bloodhound."
"It's the first murder we've ever had in Limstock. Excitement is terrific. Hope the police can handle it all right."
"I shouldn't worry," I said. "They're an efficient body of men."
"Can't even remember what the girl looked like, although I suppose she's opened the door to me dozens of times. Quiet, insignificant little thing. Knocked on the head, and then stabbed through the back of the neck, so Owen tells me. Looks like a boyfriend to me. What do you think?"
"That's your solution?"
"Seems the most likely one. Had a quarrel, I expect. They're very inbred round here."
She paused and then went on. "I hear Megan Hunter found the body. Must have given her a bit of a shock." I said shortly, "It did."
"Not too good for her, I should imagine. In my opinion, she's not too strong in the head, and a thing like this might send her completely off her onion."
I took a sudden resolution. I had to know something. "Tell me, Miss Griffith, was it you who persuaded Megan to return home yesterday?"
"Well, I wouldn't say exactly persuaded."
I stuck to my guns. "But you did say something to her." Amy Griffith planted her feet firmly and stared me in the eyes. She was just slightly on the defensive. She said, "It's no good that young woman shirking her responsibilities. She's young and she doesn't know how tongues wag. So I felt it my duty to give her a hint."
"Tongues?"
I broke off because I was too angry to go on.
Amy Griffith continued with that maddeningly complacent confidence in herself, which was her chief characteristic. "Oh, I dare say you don't hear all the gossip that goes round. I do. I know what people are saying. Mind you, I don't for a minute think there's anything in it. Not for a minute. But you know what people are. If they can say something ill-natured, they do. And it's rather hard lines on the girl when she's got her living to earn."
"Her living to earn?" I said, puzzled.
Amy went on, "It's a difficult position for her, naturally, and I think she did the right thing. I mean, she couldn't go off at a moment's notice and leave the children with no one to look after them. She's been splendid, absolutely splendid. I say so to everybody. But there it is. It's an invidious position, and people will talk."
"Who are you talking about?" I asked.
"Elsie Holland, of course," said Amy Griffith impatiently. "In my opinion, she's a thoroughly nice girl, and has only been doing her duty."
"And what are people saying?"
Amy Griffith laughed. It was, I thought, rather an unpleasant laugh. "They're saying that she's already considering the possibility of becoming Mrs. Symington number two, that she's all out to console the widower and make herself indispensable." "But good God," I said, shocked, "Mrs. Symington's only been dead a week." Amy Griffith shrugged her shoulders. "Of course, it's absurd, but you know what people are. The Holland girl is young and she's good-looking. That's enough. And mind you, being a nursery governess isn't much of a prospect for a girl. I wouldn't blame her if she wanted a settled home and a husband and was playing her cards accordingly. Of course," she went on, poor Dick Symington hasn't the least idea of all this. He's still completely knocked out by Mona Symington's death. But you know what men are. If the girl is always there, making him comfortable, looking after him, being obviously devoted to the children, well, he gets to be dependent on her. I said quietly, "So you do think that Elsie Holland is a designing hussy?" Amy Griffith flushed. "Not at all. I'm sorry for the girl, with people saying nasty things. That's why I more or less told Megan that she ought to go home. It looks better than having Dick Symington and the girl alone in the house." I began to understand things. Amy Griffith gave her jolly laugh. "You're shocked, Mr. Burton, at hearing what our gossiping little town thinks. I can tell you this, they always think the worst." She laughed and nodded and strode away. I came upon Mr. Pye by the church. He was talking to Emily Barton, who looked pink and excited. Mr. Pye greeted me with every evidence of delight. "Ah, Burton, good morning, good morning. How is your charming sister?" I told him that Joanna was well. "But not joining our village parliament. We're all agog over the news. Murder. Real Sunday newspaper murder in our midst. Not the most interesting of crimes, I fear. Somewhat sordid. The brutal murder of a little serving maid. No finer points about the crime, but still, undeniably, news." Miss Barton said tremulously, "It is shocking, quite shocking." Mr. Pye turned to her. "But you enjoy it, dear lady. You enjoy it. Confess it now. You disapprove, you deplore, but there is the thrill. I insist, there is the thrill." "Such a nice girl," said Emily Barton. "She came to me from St. Clotilde's home. Quite a raw girl, but most teachable. She turned into such a nice little maid. Partridge was very pleased with her." I said quickly, "She was coming to tea with Partridge yesterday afternoon." I turned to Pye. "I expect Amy Griffith told you." My tone was quite casual. Pye responded apparently quite unsuspiciously. "She did mention it, yes. She said, I remember, that it was something quite new for servants to ring up on their employers' telephones."
"Partridge would never dream of doing such a thing," said Miss Emily, "and I am really surprised at Agnes doing so."
"You are behind the times, dear lady," said Mr. Pye. "My two terrors used the telephone constantly and smoked all over the house until I objected. But one daren't say too much. Prescott is a divine cook, though temperamental, and Mrs. Prescott is an admirable house parlourmaid."
"Yes, indeed. We all think you're very lucky."
I intervened, since I did not want the conversation to become purely domestic. "The news of the murder has—"
of course," said Mr. Pye. "The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. Enter rumour painted full of tongues. Limstock, alas, is going to the dogs. Anonymous letters, murders, any amount of criminal tendencies."
Emily Barton said nervously,
"They don't think... there's no idea that the two are connected."
Mr. Pye pounced on the idea.
"An interesting speculation. The girl knew something, therefore she was murdered. Yes, yes, most promising. How clever of you to think of it. I can't bear it."
Emily Barton spoke abruptly and turned away, walking very fast. Pye looked after her. His cherubic face was pursed up quizzically. He turned back to me and shook his head gently.
"A sensitive soul. A charming creature, don't you think? Absolutely a period piece. She's not, you know, of her own generation. She's of the generation before that. The mother must have been a woman of a very strong character. She kept the family time ticking at about 1870, I should say. The whole family preserved under a glass case. I do like to come across that sort of thing."
I did not want to talk about period pieces. "What do you really think about all this business?" I asked.
"Meaning by that?"
"Anonymous letters. Murder.
Our local crime wave. What do you?"
"I asked you first," I said pleasantly. Mr. Pye said gently,
"I'm a student, you know, of abnormalities. They interest me. Such apparently unlikely people do the most fantastic things. Take the case of Lizzie Borden. There's not really a reasonable explanation of that. In this case, my advice to the police would be, study character. Leave your fingerprints and your measuring of handwriting and your microscopes. Notice instead what people do with their hands and their little tricks of manner and the way they eat their food, and if they laugh sometimes for no apparent reason. I raised my eyebrows. Mad? I said. Quite mad, said Mr. Pye, and added, but you'd never know it. Who? His eyes met mine. He smiled. No, Burton. That would be slander. We can't add slander to all the rest of it. He fairly skipped off. As I stood staring after him, the church door opened, and the Reverend Caleb Dane Calthrop came out. He smiled vaguely at me. Good morning, Mr. I helped him. Burton. Of course. You mustn't think I don't remember you. Your name had just slipped my memory for the moment. A beautiful day?
Yes, I said rather shortly. He peered at me.
But something... Ah, yes, that poor unfortunate child who was in service at the Symingtons. I find it hard to believe, I must confess, that we have a murderer in our midst, Mr. Burton.
It does seem a bit fantastic, I said.
Something else has just reached my ears.
He leaned towards me.
I learn that there have been anonymous letters going about. Have you heard any rumour of such things?
I have heard, I said.
Cowardly and dastardly things.
He paused and quoted an enormous stream of Latin.
Those words of Horace are very applicable, don't you think? He said.
Absolutely, I said. There didn't seem anyone more I could profitably talk to, so I went home, dropping in for some tobacco and for a bottle of sherry, so as to get some of the humbler opinions on the crime. A nasty tramp, seemed to be the verdict. Come to the door, they do, and whine and ask for money, and then, if it's a girl alone in the house, they turn nasty. My sister Dora over to Coomaker, she had a nasty experience one day, drunk he was, and selling those little printed poems. The story went on, ending with the intrepid Dora courageously banging the door in the man's face and taking refuge and barricading herself in some vague retreat, which I gathered from the delicacy in mentioning it must be the lavatory. And there she stayed till her lady came home. I reached Little Furze just a few minutes before lunchtime. Joanna was standing in the drawing-room window doing nothing at all and looking as though her thoughts were miles away. "What have you been doing with yourself?" I asked.
"Oh, I don't know. Nothing particular."
I went out on the veranda. Two chairs were drawn up to an iron table, and there were two empty sherry glasses. On another chair was an object at which I looked with bewilderment for some time. "What on earth is this?"
"Oh," said Joanna, "I think it's a photograph of a diseased spleen or something. Dr. Griffiths seemed to think I'd be interested to see it."
I looked at the photograph with some interest. Every man has his own ways of courting the female sex. I should not myself choose to do it with photographs of spleens, diseased or otherwise. Still, no... It looks most unpleasant, I said. Joanna said it did, rather. How was Griffith? I asked.
He looked tired and very unhappy. I think he's got something on his mind.
A spleen that won't yield to treatment?
Don't be silly. I mean something real.
I should say the man's got you on his mind. I wish you'd lay off him, Joanna.
Oh, do shut up. I haven't done anything.
Women always say that. Joanna whirled angrily out of the room. The diseased spleen was beginning to curl up in the sun. I took it by one corner and brought it into the drawing room. I had no affection for it myself, but I presumed it was one of Griffith's treasures. I stooped down and pulled out a heavy book from the bottom shelf of the bookcase in order to press the photograph flat again between its leaves. It was a ponderous volume of somebody's sermons. The book came open in my hand in rather a surprising way. In another minute I saw why. From the middle of it, a number of pages had been neatly cut out. I stood staring at it. I looked at the title page. It had been published in 1840. There could be no doubt at all. I was looking at the book from the pages of which the anonymous letters had been put together. Who had cut them out? Well, to begin with, it could be Emily Barton herself. She was perhaps the obvious person to think of. Or it could have been Partridge. But there were other possibilities. The pages could have been cut out by anyone who had been alone in this room, any visitor, for instance, who had sat there waiting for Miss Emily, or even anyone who had called on business. No, that wasn't so likely. I had noticed that when one day a clerk from the bank had come to see me, Partridge had shown him into the little study at the back of the house. That was clearly the house routine. A visitor, then. Someone of good social position. Mr. Pye? Amy Griffith? Mrs. Dane Calthrop? The gong sounded, and I went in to lunch. Afterwards, in the drawing-room, I showed Joanna my find. We discussed it from every aspect. Then I took it down to the police station. They were elated at the find, and I was patted on the back for what was, after all, the sheerest piece of luck. Graves was not there, but Nash was, and rang up the other man. They would test the book for fingerprints, though Nash was not hopeful of finding anything. I may say that he did not. There were mine, Partridge's, and nobody else's, merely showing that Partridge dusted conscientiously. Nash walked back with me up the hill. I asked how he was getting on. "We're narrowing it down, Mr. Burton. We've eliminated the people it couldn't be." "Ah," I said, "and who remains?" "Miss Skinch. She was to meet a client at a house yesterday afternoon by appointment. The house was situated not far along the Coomaker Road. That's the road that goes past the Symingtons. She would have to pass the house, both going and coming. The week before, the day the anonymous letter was delivered, and Mrs. Symington committed suicide, was her last day at Symington's office. Mr. Symington thought at first she'd not left the office at all that afternoon. He had Sir Henry Lushington with him all the afternoon, and rang several times for Miss Ginch. I find, however, that she did leave the office between 3 and 4. She went out to get some high denomination of stamp, of which they'd run short. The office boy could have gone, but Miss Ginch elected to go, saying she had a headache and would like the air. She was not gone long. Yes, long enough to hurry along to the other end of the village, slip the letter in the box and hurry back. I must say, however, that I cannot find anybody who saw her near the Symington's house. Would they notice? They might, and they might not. Who else is in your bag? Nash looked very straight ahead of him. You'll understand that we can't exclude anybody. Anybody at all? No, I said. I see that. He said gravely, Miss Griffith went to Brentham for a meeting of girl guides yesterday. She arrived rather late. You don't think? No, I don't think. But I don't know. Miss Griffith seems an eminently sane, healthy-minded woman. But I say, I don't know. What about the previous week? Could she have slipped the letter in the box? It's possible. She was shopping in the town that afternoon. He paused. The same applies to Miss Emily Barton. She was out shopping early yesterday afternoon, and she went for a walk to see some friends on the road past the Symington's house the week before. I shook my head unbelievingly. Finding the cut book in Little Furze was bound, I knew, to direct attention to the owner of that house. But when I remembered Miss Emily coming in yesterday so bright and happy and excited... Damn it all. Excited, yes, excited. Pink cheeks, shining eyes. Surely not because. Not because. I said thickly, This business is bad for one. One sees things, one imagines things. Yes. It isn't very pleasant to look upon the fellow creatures one meets as possible criminal lunatics. He paused for a moment, then went on. And there's Mr. Pye. I said sharply, So you have considered him? Nash smiled. Oh, yes. We've considered him all right. A very curious character. Not, I should say, a very nice character. He's got no alibi. He was in his garden alone on both occasions. So you're not only suspecting women... I don't think a man wrote the letters. In fact, I'm sure of it. And so is Graves. Always excepting our Mr. Pye, that is to say, who's got an abnormally female streak in his character. But we've checked up on everybody for yesterday afternoon. That's a murder case, you see. You're all right, he grinned. And so is your sister. And Mr. Symington didn't leave his office after he got there. And Dr. Griffith was on a round in the other direction. and I've checked up on his visits. He paused, smiled again, and said, "You see?" I said slowly, "So, your case is eliminated down to those four. Miss Ginch, Mr. Pye, Miss Griffith, and little Miss Barton?" "Oh, no, no, we've got a couple more. Besides the vicar's lady." "You've thought of her?" "We've thought of everybody. But Mrs. Dane Calthrop is a little too openly mad, if you know what I mean. Still, she could have done it. She was in a wood watching birds yesterday afternoon, and the birds can't speak for her." He turned sharply as Owen Griffith came into the police station. "Hello, Nash. I heard you were round asking for me this morning. Anything important?" "Inquest on Friday, if that suits you, Dr. Griffith." "Right. Moresby and I are doing the PM tonight." Nash said, "There's just one other thing, Dr. Griffith. Mrs. Symington was taking some cachets, powders or something, that you prescribed for her." He paused. Owen Griffith said interrogatively, "Yes?" "Would an overdose of those cachets have been fatal?" Griffith said dryly, "Certainly not. Not unless she'd taken about 25 of them. But you once warned her about exceeding the dose, so Miss Holland tells me." "Oh, that, yes. Mrs. Symington was the sort of woman who would go and overdo anything she was given. Fancy that to take twice as much would do her twice as much good. And you don't want anyone to overdo even phenacetin or aspirin. Bad for the heart. And anyway, there's absolutely no doubt about the cause of death. It was cyanide." "Oh, I know that. You don't get my meaning. I only thought that when committing suicide, you'd prefer to take an overdose of a soporific rather than to feed yourself prussic acid." "Oh, quite. On the other hand, prussic acid is more dramatic and is pretty certain to do the trick. With barbiturates, for instance, you can bring the victim round if only a short time has elapsed." "I see. Thank you, Dr. Griffith." Griffith departed, and I said goodbye to Nash. I went slowly up the hill home. Joanna was out, at least there was no sign of her, and there was an enigmatical memorandum scribbled on the telephone block, presumably for the guidance of either Partridge or myself. "If Dr. Griffith rings up, I can't go on Tuesday, but could manage Wednesday or Thursday." I raised my eyebrows and went into the drawing room. I sat down in the most comfortable armchair. None of them were very comfortable. They tended to have straight backs and were reminiscent of the late Mrs. Barton. Stretched out my legs and tried to think the whole thing out. With sudden annoyance, I remembered that Owen's arrival had interrupted my conversation with the inspector, and that he had just mentioned two other people as being possibilities. I wondered who they were. Partridge, perhaps, for one? After all, the cut book had been found in this house. And Agnes could have been struck down quite unsuspecting by her guide and mentor. No, you couldn't eliminate Partridge. But who was the other? Somebody, perhaps, that I didn't know. Mrs. Cleet, the original. I closed my eyes. I considered four people, strangely unlikely people, in turn. Gentle, frail little Emily Barton. What points were there actually against her? A starved life? Dominated and repressed from early childhood? Too many sacrifices asked of her? A curious horror of discussing anything not quite nice? Was that actually a sign of inner preoccupation with just these themes? Was I getting too horribly Freudian? I remembered a doctor once telling me that the mutterings of gentle maiden ladies when going off under an anaesthetic were a revelation. You wouldn't think they knew such words. Amy Griffith. Surely nothing repressed or inhibited about her. Cheery, mannish, successful. A full, busy life. Yet Mrs. Dane Calthrop had said, "Poor thing." And there was something. Something. Some remembrance. Ah, I got it. Owen Griffith saying something like, "We had an outbreak of anonymous letters up north where I had a practice." Had that been Amy Griffith's work too? Surely rather a coincidence. Two outbreaks of the same thing. Stop a minute. They'd tracked down the author of those. Griffith had said so. A schoolgirl. Cold it was suddenly. Must be a draught from the window. I turned uncomfortably in my chair. Why did I suddenly feel so queer and upset? Go on thinking. Amy Griffith. Perhaps it was Amy Griffith, not that other girl. And Amy had come down here and started her tricks again. And that was why Owen Griffith was looking so unhappy and hag-ridden. He suspected. Yes, he suspected. Mr. Pye. Not, somehow, a very nice little man. I could imagine him staging the whole business. Laughing. That telephone message on the telephone pad in the hall. Why did I keep thinking of it? Griffith and Joanna. He was falling for her. No, that wasn't why the message worried me. It was something else. My senses were swimming. Sleep was very near. I repeated idiotically to myself, "No smoke without fire. No smoke without fire. That's it. It all." And then I was walking down the street with Megan, and Elsie Holland passed. She was dressed as a bride, and people were murmuring. She's going to marry Dr. Griffith at last. Of course, they've been engaged secretly for years. There we were, in the church, and Dane Calthrop was reading the service in Latin. And in the middle of it, Mrs. Dane Calthrop jumped up and cried energetically, "It's got to be stopped, I tell you! It's got to be stopped!" For a minute or two, I didn't know whether I was asleep or awake. Then my brain cleared, and I realised I was in the drawing room of Little Furs, and that Mrs. Dane Calthrop had just come through the window and was standing in front of me saying with nervous violence, "It has got to be stopped, I tell you!" I jumped up. I said, "I beg your pardon. I'm afraid I was asleep. What did you say?" Mrs. Dane Calthrop beat one fist fiercely on the palm of her other hand. "It's got to be stopped. These letters. Murder! You can't go on having poor innocent children like Agnes Waddle killed." "You're quite right," I said. "But how do you propose to set about it?" Mrs. Dane Calthrop said, "We've got to do something." I smiled, perhaps in rather a superior fashion. "And what do you suggest that we should do?" "Get the whole thing cleared up. I said this wasn't a wicked place. I was wrong. It is." I felt annoyed. I said, not too politely, "Yes, my dear woman, but what are you going to do?" Mrs. Dane Calthrop said, "Put a stop to it all, of course. The police are doing their best. If Agnes could be killed yesterday, their best isn't good enough." "So you know better than they do?" "Not at all. I don't know anything at all. That's why I'm going to call in an expert." I shook my head. "You can't do that. Scotland Yard will only take over on a demand from the chief constable of the county. Actually, they have sent Graves." "I don't mean that kind of an expert. I don't mean someone who knows about anonymous letters or even about murder. I mean someone who knows people. Don't you see? We want someone who knows a great deal about wickedness." It was a queer point of view, but it was somehow stimulating. Before I could say anything more, Mrs. Dane Calthrop nodded her head at me and said in a quick, confident tone, "I'm going to see about it right away." And she went out of the window again. Chapter 10. The next week, I think, was one of the queerest times I have ever passed through. It had an odd dream quality. Nothing seemed real. The inquest on Agnes Waddle was held, and the curious of Limstock attended en masse. No new facts came to light, and the only possible verdict was returned. Murder by person or persons unknown. So poor little Agnes Waddle, having had her hour of limelight, was duly buried in the quiet old churchyard, and life in Limstock went on as before. No, that last statement is untrue. Not as before. There was a half-scared, half-avid gleam in almost everybody's eye. Neighbour looked at neighbour. One thing had been brought out clearly at the inquest. It was most unlikely that any stranger had killed Agnes Waddle. No tramps nor unknown men had been noticed, nor reported in the district. Somewhere, then, in Limstock, walking down the high street, shopping, passing the time of day, was a person who had cracked a defenceless girl's skull and driven a sharp skewer home to her brain. And no one knew who that person was. As I say, the days went by in a kind of dream. I looked at everyone I met in a new light, the light of a possible murderer. It was not an agreeable sensation. And in the evenings, with the curtain drawn, Joanna and I sat talking, talking, arguing, going over in turn all the various possibilities that still seemed so fantastic and incredible. Joanna held firm to her theory of Mr. Pye. I, after wavering a little, had gone back to my original suspect, Miss Ginch. But we went over the possible names again and again. Mr. Pye, Miss Ginch, Mrs. Dane Calthrop, Amy Griffith, Emily Barton, Partridge. And all the time, nervously, apprehensively, we waited for something to happen. But nothing did happen. Nobody, so far as we knew, received any more letters. Nash made periodic appearances in the town, but what he was doing and what traps the police were setting, I had no idea. Graves had gone again. Emily Barton came to tea. Megan came to lunch. Owen Griffith went about his practice. We went and drank sherry with Mr. Pye. And we went to tea at the vicarage. I was glad to find Mrs. Dane Calthrop displayed none of the militant ferocity she had shown on the occasion of our last meeting. I think she had forgotten all about it. She seemed now principally concerned with the destruction of white butterflies so as to preserve cauliflower. Our afternoon at the vicarage was really one of the most peaceful we had spent. It was an attractive old house and had a big, shabby, comfortable drawing room with faded rose cretonne. The Dane Calthrops had a guest staying with them, an amiable elderly lady who was knitting something with white fleecy wool. We had very good hot scones for tea. The vicar came in and beamed placidly on us whilst he pursued his gentle erudite conversation. It was very pleasant. I don't mean that we got away from the topic of the murder, because we didn't. Miss Marple, the guest, was naturally thrilled by the subject. As she said apologetically, "We have so little to talk about in the country." She had made up her mind that the dead girl must have been just like her Edith. Such a nice little maid, and so willing, but sometimes just a little slow to take in things. Miss Marple also had a cousin whose niece's sister-in-law had had a great deal of annoyance and trouble over some anonymous letters. So the letters also were very interesting to the charming old lady. "But tell me, dear," she said to Mrs. Dane Calthrop, "what do the village people, I mean the townspeople, say? What do they think?"
"Mrs. Cleet still, I suppose," said Joanna.
"Oh, no," said Mrs. Dane Calthrop. "Not now." Miss Marple asked who Mrs. Cleet was. Joanna said she was the village witch.
"That's right, isn't it, Mrs. Dane Calthrop?"
The vicar murmured a long Latin quotation about, I think, the evil power of witches, to which we all listened in respectful and uncomprehending silence. "She's a very silly woman," said his wife. "Likes to show off. Goes out to gather herbs and things at the full of the moon, and takes care that everybody in the place knows about it."
"And silly girls go and consult her, I suppose," said Miss Marple.
I saw the vicar getting ready to unload more Latin on us, and I asked hastily, "But why shouldn't people suspect her of the murder now? They thought the letters were her doing." Miss Marple said,
"Oh, but the girl was killed with a skewer, so I hear. Very unpleasant. Well, naturally, that takes all suspicion away from this Mrs. Cleet. Because, you see, she could ill-wish her, so that the girl would waste away and die from natural causes."
"Strange how the old beliefs linger," said the vicar. "In early Christian times, local superstitions were wisely incorporated with Christian doctrines, and their more unpleasant attributes gradually eliminated."
"It isn't superstition we've got to deal with here," said Mrs. Dane Calthrop, "but facts." "And very unpleasant facts," I said.
"As you say, Mr. Burton," said Miss Marple. "Now you, excuse me if I'm being too personal, are a stranger here, and have a knowledge of the world and of various aspects of life. It seems to me that you ought to be able to find a solution to this distasteful problem."
I smiled. "The best solution I've had was a dream. In my dream it all fitted in and panned out beautifully. Unfortunately, when I woke up, the whole thing was nonsense."
"How interesting, though.
Oh, it all started with the silly phrase, 'No smoke without fire.' People have been saying that ad nauseam.
And then I got it mixed up with war terms. Smoke screens, scrap of paper, telephone messages. No, that was another dream. And what was that dream? The old lady was so eager about it that I felt sure she was a secret reader of Napoleon's Book of Dreams, which had been the great standby of my old nurse. Oh, only Elsie Holland, the Symington's nursery governess, you know, was getting married to Dr. Griffith, and the vicar here was reading the service in Latin. Very appropriate, dear, murmured Mrs. Dane Calthrop to her spouse. And then Mrs. Dane Calthrop got up and forbade the banns and said it had got to be stopped. But that part, I added with a smile, was true. I woke up and found you standing over me saying it. And I was quite right, said Mrs. Dane Calthrop, but quite mildly, I was glad to note. But where did a telephone message come in? Asked Miss Marple, crinkling her brows. I'm afraid I'm being rather stupid. That wasn't in the dream. It was just before it. I came through the hall and noticed Joanna had written down a message to be given to someone if they rang up. Miss Marple leaned forward. There was a pink spot in each cheek. Will you think me very inquisitive and very rude if I ask just what that message was? She cast a glance at Joanna. I do apologise, my dear. Joanna, however, was highly entertained. Oh, I don't mind, she assured the old lady. I can't remember anything about it myself, but perhaps Jerry can. It must have been something quite trivial. Solemnly I repeated the message as best I could remember it, enormously tickled at the old lady's rapt attention. I was afraid the actual words were going to disappoint her, but perhaps she had some sentimental idea of a romance, for she nodded her head and smiled and seemed pleased. I see, she said. I thought it might be something like that. Mrs. Dane Calthrop said sharply, Like what, Jane? Something quite ordinary, said Miss Marple. She looked at me thoughtfully for a moment or two. Then she said unexpectedly, I can see you are a very clever young man, but not quite enough confidence in yourself. You ought to have. Joanna gave a loud hoot. For goodness sake, don't encourage him to feel like that. He thinks quite enough of himself as it is. Be quiet, Joanna, I said. Miss Marple understands me. Miss Marple had resumed her fleecy knitting. You know, she observed pensively, to commit a successful murder must be very much like bringing off a conjuring trick. The quickness of the hand deceives the eye. Not only that, you've got to make people look at the wrong thing and in the wrong place. Misdirection, they call it, I believe. Well, I remarked, so far everybody seems to have looked in the wrong place. I should be inclined myself, said Miss Marple, to look for somebody very sane. Yes, I said thoughtfully. That's what Nash said. I remember he stressed respectability, too. Yes, agreed Miss Marple. That's very important. Well, we all seemed agreed. I addressed Mrs. Calthrop. Nash thinks, I said, that there will be more anonymous letters. What do you think? She said slowly, There may be, I suppose. If the police think that, there will have to be, no doubt, said Miss Marple. I went on doggedly to Mrs. Dane Calthrop. Are you still sorry for the writer? She flushed. Why not? I don't think I agree with you, dear, said Miss Marple. Not in this case, I said hotly. They've driven one woman to suicide and caused untold misery and heartburnings. Have you had one, Miss Burton? Asked Miss Marple of Joanna. Joanna gurgled. Oh, yes. It said the most frightful things. I'm afraid, said Miss Marple, that the people who are young and pretty are apt to be singled out by the writer. That's why I certainly think it's odd that Elsie Holland hasn't had any, I said. Let me see, said Miss Marple. Is that the Symington's nursery governess? The one you dreamt about, Mr. Burton? Yes. She's probably had one and won't say so, said Joanna. No, I said. I believe her. So does Nash. Dear me, said Miss Marple. Now, that's very interesting. That's the most interesting thing I've heard yet.
As we were going home, Joanna told me that I ought not to have repeated what Nash said about letters coming. Why not? Because Mrs. Dane Calthrop might be it. You don't really believe that? I'm not sure. She's a queer woman. We began our discussion of probables all over again. It was two nights later that I was coming back in the car from Exhampton. I had had dinner there and then started back, and it was already dark before I got into Limstock. Something was wrong with the car lights, and after slowing up and switching on and off, I finally got out to see what I could do. I was some time fiddling, but I managed to fix them up finally. The road was quite deserted. Nobody in Limstock is about after dark. The first few houses were just ahead, amongst them the ugly gabled building of the Women's Institute. It loomed up in the dim starlight, and something impelled me to go and have a look at it. I don't know whether I'd caught a faint glimpse of a stealthy figure flitting through the gate. If so, it must have been so indeterminate that it did not register in my conscious mind. But I did suddenly feel a kind of overwhelming. The gate was slightly ajar, and I pushed it open and walked in. A short path and four steps led up to the door. I stood there a moment, hesitating. What was I really doing there? I didn't know. And then, suddenly, just near at hand, I caught the sound of a rustle. It sounded like a woman's dress. I took a sharp turn and went round the corner of the building towards where the sound had come from. I couldn't see anybody. I went on and again turned a corner. I was at the back of the house now, and suddenly I saw, only 2 feet away from me, an open window. I crept up to it and listened. I could hear nothing, but somehow or other I felt convinced that there was someone inside. My back wasn't too good for acrobatics as yet, but I managed to hoist myself up and drop over the sill inside. I made rather a noise, unfortunately. I stood just inside the window, listening. Then I walked forward, my hands outstretched. I heard then the faintest sound ahead of me to my right. I had a torch in my pocket, and I switched it on. Immediately, a low, sharp voice said, "Put that out!" I obeyed instantly, for in that brief second, I had recognised Superintendent Nash. I felt him take my arm and propel me through a door and into a passage. Here, where there was no window to betray our presence to anyone outside, he switched on a lamp and looked at me more in sorrow than in anger. "You would have to butt in just that minute, Mr. Burton." "Sorry," I apologised, "but I got a hunch that I was onto something." "And so you were, probably. Did you see anyone?" I hesitated. "I'm not sure," I said slowly. "I've got a vague feeling I saw someone sneak in through the front gate, but I didn't really see anyone. Then I heard a rustle round the side of the house." Nash nodded. "That's right. Somebody came round the house before you. They hesitated by the window, then went on quickly." "Heard you, I expect." I apologised again. "What's the big idea?" I asked. Nash said, "I'm banking on the fact that an anonymous letter writer can't stop writing letters. She may know it's dangerous, but she'll have to do it. It's like a craving for drink or drugs." I nodded. "Now, you see, Mr. Burton, I fancy whoever it is will want to keep the letters looking the same as much as possible. She's got the cut-out pages of that book and can go on using letters and words cut out of them. But the envelopes present a difficulty. She'll want to type them on the same machine. She can't risk using another typewriter or her own handwriting." "Do you really think she'll go on with the game?" I asked incredulously. "Yes, I do. And I'll bet you anything you like she's full of confidence. They're always vain as hell, these people. Well, then, I figured out that whoever it was would come to the Institute after dark so as to get at the typewriter." "Miss Ginch?" I said. "Maybe. You don't know yet." "I don't know." "Yes. But somebody's very cunning, Mr. Burton. Somebody knows all the tricks of the game." I could imagine some of the network that Nash had spread abroad. I had no doubt that every letter written by a suspect and posted or left by hand was immediately inspected. Sooner or later, the criminal would slip up, would grow careless. For the third time, I apologised for my zealous and unwanted presence. "Oh, well," said Nash philosophically, "can't be helped. Better luck next time." I went out into the night. A dim figure was standing beside my car. To my astonishment, I recognised Megan. "Hello," she said. "I thought this was your car. What have you been doing?" "What are you doing is much more to the point," I said. "I'm out for a walk. I like walking at night. Nobody stops you and says silly things. And I like the stars, and things smell better, and everyday things look all mysterious." "All of that I grant you freely," I said. "But only cats and witches walk in the dark. They'll wonder about you at home." "No, they won't. They never wonder where I am or what I'm doing." "How are you getting on?" I asked. "All right, I suppose. Miss Holland look after you and all that?" "Elsie's all right. She can't help being a perfect fool." "Unkind, but probably true," I said. "Hop in and I'll drive you home." It was not quite true that Megan was never missed. Symington was standing on the doorstep as we drove up. He peered towards us. "Hello, is Megan there?" "Yes," I said, "I've brought her home." Symington said sharply, "You mustn't go off like this without telling us, Megan. Miss Holland has been quite worried about you." Megan muttered something and went past him into the house. Symington sighed. "A grown-up girl has a great responsibility with no mother to look after her. She's too old for school, I suppose." He looked towards me rather suspiciously. "I suppose you took her for a drive." I thought it best to leave it like that.
End of Disc 5.